Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, listeners. This episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast may feature spoilers for events that come later on in the series. So be warned.
Be warned.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat. This is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast brought to you by Sci-Fi Wire. My name is Mark Bernardin.
And I'm Trisha Helfer.
Hey, T-Dog, how you doing?
I'm good. I sound a little more awake than you do.
Yeah,
you got
well.
Your gravelly morning voice.
I got my gravelly morning voice. I've got my my Mel Gibson and Lethal Weapon waking up and first thing lighting a cigarette before even drinking coffee voice.
Did you have a late night?
Yeah, I was podcasting my other podcast.
Oh, well, look at you, fancy.
I know, I'm two-timing you.
two-timing me with Kevin Smith, I think that's okay.
Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
Where we did talk about you at length. Or actually at height.
You did.
We did, because we were talking about the Plague Nerdalogs, and I mentioned that that you had contributed a lovely rendition of Bill from Kill Bill Volume 2. And it was like, oh, well, Trisha gets in there first. What has she got on me? And I'm like, I don't know, about a foot and a half.
True, probably. Which,
yeah, true.
Oh, we will have to do a podcast together sometime.
Indeed. Indeed. But yeah. Yes, so that is why I was up late, not smoking and or drinking, but just talking about nerd shit, as you
right. Do. Well, good on you for doing the nerd plague nerdalogs, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a fun project to put together.
And you've raised a lot of money. So yay, Mark.
Yeah, we've raised some money and we're raising more money for No Kid Hungry benefits, you know. And hopefully by the time you listen to this, the coronavirus is over and we conquered it and it's done and we're all back to normal. I probably don't think so. But
we can be hopeful.
We can be hopeful, and you know that money will still go to the people who need it, namely exactly. Children who need it. So
exactly.
Well, but good we're on not you. Talking about plagues today. We're not talking nope. about.
We're talking faith.
We're talking about faith. We're talking about. We're talking about the sixth episode of the fourth season of Battlestar Galactica, the final season of Battlestar Galactica.
And we have a special guest.
We do indeed. But before we bring him on, let's just quickly hit the previously on, just so yes. we don't have to pause for the cause.
Previously so, on was a yeah. the name of a poem, an episode with the name of a poem.
Ooh, what was it?
The Road Less Traveled.
Oh, that's right. The Robert Frost.
Yes. And it was, we see the reemergence of Leoben.
Mm-hmm.
After an episode or two that was light on the Demetrius and heavy on the remaining three Cylons of Galactica, we had a Demetrius heavy episode with Return of Leoben.
Indeed. And the mutiny that is staged on the Demetrius Bridge, reluctantly led by Hilo, calling into question Kara's leadership abilities. And hey, Baltar and Tyrell are buddies now after what seemed to be a somewhat contentious meeting in Baltar's girly, groupie, sex, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, and that leads us to the ongoings of Faith, which was written by Seamus Kevin Fahey and directed by our guest, Michael Nankin. Hey, Michael Nankin, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning. I hope I can match your energy level.
Yeah. Welcome to the Yak Pack. It's Michael Nankin. How are you?
You have directed so many of these episodes, but it's your first time being on. So we're very
That's
excited.
True. And what are we going to do about that?
We're just going to have you as a guest for the next, I don't know, 21. And again, it's Michael Nankin. I didn't direct this one, but I wanted to be here.
Yeah, we'll see if he says that after, at the end of this podcast.
After a routine grilling by Tricia. Well, tell us, Michael, before you even press play on the episode, tell us about your entree into the Battlestar universe.
I was working on a miniseries with David Icke for Sci-Fi while he was gearing up with Ron Moore on the reboot. And at that time, all I knew about Battlestar was the original. And, you know, and my attitude was like, really that? Anyway, so we did a lot of work for Sci-Fi, which they rejected and canceled the project. I think Battlestar was in its first season at that point. And I turned to David Icke and said, look, I just did all this work. Sci-Fi shut us down. I need some cash. Can you bring me on your show? And that was my way into Battlestar. I needed an infusion of money. And I was working with David Icke, and he brought me in, and I had no expectations, a heavy dose of skepticism. And after one day, I called him, and I said, I'm never leaving. Like, you have to, like, this is it. This is where I live now, and I'm never leaving Battlestar. And I adore all these people, and the scripts are great, and I've never had a better time.
You said this was in the first season, or the first season had aired and this was the second season?
This is the second season.
Okay. Had you seen some of the first season?
Not at that point. No, I just was still thinking, like, how would they like make anything out of that old show?
Well, you guys did.
And I do appreciate the, you know, you won't get anything unless you ask for it. Like, hey man, I need a job. Give me a job. Okay. I'm giving you the best job.
It is the best job.
It is the best job.
Do you know how many you directed over the seasons?
I did six or eight.
Oh, it seems like more than that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm a big presence in that
world. Yeah, I was just going to say, you left such an impression that I thought there was way more than that.
But, I hung around a lot, you know.
You were there even when you weren't directing.
I just didn't want to go home. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure that at this point, it's no secret to the fans that as dark as the show was, the set was teddy bears and lollipops. We all adored each other.
Yeah, we did. And we still do. That's the crazy, wonderfulness of it all.
Yeah. It's the thing that I bet viewers never understand is that dramas tend to have the most lovely environments, you know, mood-wise, morale-wise. Comedies are awful, awful places. Filled with everybody who kind of sort of hates each other.
Interesting. A producer I worked with long ago, I was doing a thriller, very dark thriller with him. And he said, oh, so you're an optimist. I said, what do you mean? And he said, optimists write cautionary dramas because they think there's still hope. And pessimists write comedies because they know that in any instance, man will screw up.
Seems fair. All right, so we're going to press play now. We are not on the sci-fi.com feed, so we will not have commercials. We're just blazing right on through. So I just have the 12 cell line models up, and here we go.
One question. Do I have to watch my language?
Not even close.
Okay. No.
Wait, why can't I stop the audio? Hold on. Why am I getting audio? Not supposed to have audio. There we go.
It just wasn't all the way to the bottom.
I was trying to, and it wasn't gonna do. Never mind. All right.
I am so technologically challenged, Michael, that whenever Mark has trouble, I secretly just am so happy.
There's a giddiness involved. It's like
not the best for the podcast, but I'm like, yes.
Like, you should just put the volume down, Mark. No, put the volume down, Mark. Why can't you get the volume down, Mark? I can see it. I felt so bad for AJ in this episode. Of anybody, I was like, oh, man, that poor guy. Like, he just looks miserable. Every time you see him, he looks miserable.
It is such a – I'm kind of jumping ahead, but – we'll get there. The scene between Hilo and Gaeta.
Okay, yeah.
I won't. When he knows that if they don't jump,
sister, do what you
want. If they don't jump back now, he's gonna lose his leg. It's so sad. Anyway, okay. So we pick up right where the The Road Less Traveled ended. That's usually what happens with a to be continued. But
yeah, Michael, when you first got this script, what did you think the biggest challenge was going to be?
I didn't really think of it in those terms. I was just giddy about. I think I was really excited about the whole idea of like doing the river stuff, the crossover on the ship, and seeing the other world, and you know, that part of it was really exciting to me.
Yeah, it is. There, when I was rewatching it yesterday, there was definitely some stuff that I had sort of forgotten, because you get invested in the Demetrius story and what's going on there and going to the base ship and everything, and then you there's this such the beautiful aspect of the whole stuff with Mary, Rosalind, and Emily, and the other, you know, crossing the river stuff, that it's just like this lightness to the episode.
Nice mix of emotions in this. I remember there was a discussion, this scene, this mutiny scene, you know, half the scene is the end of the previous episode. Mm. And then half of it's here. And I think that I ended up, rather than have one director direct half a scene and the other director direct the other half, I think I directed the whole thing. I think I did the end of the previous episode as well.
Oh, really?
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it was silly to stage it twice with two different directors.
Yeah, I mean, would have that been a Harvey Friend idea of like a money idea, or would that have been a creative idea?
It was
because I've seen two directors work together of when it's something like that, and they go, okay, they collectively decide on what the look is going to be like for a scene when it's split like that.
Yeah, I think it was creative, like, you know, just staging this thing and getting all these actors and getting this thing revved up and getting the scene to work. And you're only doing half of it, just seemed like a bad idea to both of us. I can't even remember who the other director was, but oh yeah, that knee, that was a great prosthetic.
So gross.
So gross. And Michael Reimer directed The Road Less Traveled.
And he was like, oh yeah, fine, take it.
Yeah, yeah, I do love that. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it. The one thing that I hear somebody say, get the medic, but then Starbuck just goes into full on. And at first I was like, why is she doing it? But then I suppose anybody in those positions has had general first aid, right?
Right. It's just a battlefield.
Katie saw that prosthetic leg and she goes, I want my hands on that. I got to get
it. Yeah. I do like that it takes the shooting of a kneecap, the kneecapping of poor Gata to cause everybody to kind of take a beat. You know, it's like, listen, we have an actual giant crisis on our hands right here. So yes, we're all Mexican standoffing, pointing guns at each other about who's going to pull the jump button or not. And Anders, poor Anders, this guy is just always 1 minute behind the eight ball. Finally decides like, I'm going to shoot somebody in the leg. Here's what's going to happen. No issues here.
Yeah, there's no repercussions from it to him. But I guess in these times of, you know, heightened everything, something like that is more like it stopped everybody from sort of shooting each other.
Right.
Gata took it for the team.
He took one for the team. And it gives everybody a chance to kind of say, right now, what the hell are we going to do now? And even Kara, despite what seems to have been a lot of, I guess, delusion is the wrong word, but you know, her priorities were not quite in line with everybody else's, even says like, I have to keep going, but I'm just going to take a Raptor. I'm going to take a Raptor with one other person and we're going to that base ship. Everybody else gets to go home, get Gata the treatment that he needs. And it's like, it's nice to see her finally kind of stepping up a little bit, because we've spent what now, like 5 episodes with her just weird Captain Ahab.
Yeah, she's definitely been off on her, which is the whole point of it. She's been on this mission and not being herself, but it's gotten to a little bit annoying, I'm sure, for everybody and a little bit for the viewer. So to see her kind of step back into her Starbuck take charge role was nice to see.
Yeah, and at least show some kind of modicum of perspective. Like, I think that's what she'd been lacking the past few episodes, where it's just her painting in her room, you know, kind of getting all handsy-touchy with Leobin, you know, without any thought as to the sort of care and well-being of those under her command. She was just all about the mission, which, to her point, that's what Kara's always been. But now that she's got people to take care of, that's not a thing you can do anymore. I was so shocked at this the first time you see Mary.
Oh yeah. I was trying to, I had her bend over the desk so that, oh no, I'm thinking of something different. We had so much trouble with that bald wig. Mm. What you're seeing here is a CGI fixed version of a lumpy bald wig.
The
bald cap, yeah.
Well, Mary has such thick hair.
Yeah.
Right? It's so hard. Like it is. I did look at that and think, what was that movie with the cones that
Coneheads.
But bald caps are so hard to do, and especially with somebody with thick, luscious hair.
Yeah.
Because it has to go somewhere. You can't just get rid of it. And they
it was too big. And I remember I had opened the scene originally with her. She dropped something off her desk, and the first reveal is her standing up. So it was like a planet rising over a horizon. But it was just too much.
Yeah. I mean, and we found out last episode that she was wearing a wig. She tells Baltar, that was the previous episode, where she says, you know, this is a wig. And let me just tell you that I no longer care about Gaius Baltar. I don't have time in my life to give you any more of my bandwidth. And so stay in line. Otherwise, I'm just going to clap down on you harder than I've ever done it before. And so to now see her without the wig and to see her beginning to actually make plans in an odd way for the future without her. Where she's sort of empowering Tori to keep an eye on things. I'm going to rely on you more than I ever have before. Like, you have to make sure, you have to watch me, because I could start slipping. And it's you know, it's very, very poignant.
Yeah, to see her know that she's going to start slipping
and
get ahead of it. It's
this was the, sorry to change the subject, this was the first time we built the airlock that leads to the Raptor.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I remember looking at that.
I saw how people got on it.
Yeah. Like, usually it's just we're climbing onto this thing because it's on the deck. But now it's, oh, we're in one ship and now we're walking into another ship. I haven't seen that before. Oh, man. Leoben, I could listen to that dude rave about stuff all day long.
Callum's so good.
And it's always like, you know, God's plan is about to be revealed. Like, all right, man, you keep going.
Also, I think that was the first jump we did where we were inside the ship rather than seeing it disappear outside.
Ooh, that is some Star Wars type shit when you just go to hyperspace and suddenly the stars are in your face. That is cool. And man, Gary Hudsell, jeez.
Jumped right into the Cylon base ships of just torn apart.
Yeah.
It is hard to see. Like, looking at
the shot here. We had to cut a hole in the set. And I remember everyone was very upset. See the wall behind him? Mm-hmm. We had to get a camera back there. And so this shot here, the only way to get it was to destroy the set. So we did it last.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we just got a big saw and just carved a hole in the set.
This is the one that I was talking about at the beginning. This scene to me is just so heartbreaking because knowing, and Hilo says, you know, I'm not going to jump back before the 15 hours or whatever it is that they, 15 hours and 7 minutes. And Gata just knowing he's going to lose his leg the longer they stay there.
Yeah. It's like he knows exactly who Hilo is. And he's like, man, just don't be you. Like, just for a second, could you just like, look at my leg, dude. Help me out here. It's like, no, you're going to be you.
These guys killed the scene. They were so good. And the ticking clock.
I always appreciate the, we're setting the clock in the beginning, and sometimes it's a literal clock. You have 15 hours. You can always cut back to it and remind people, oh, you know, the heat's on. The pressure's rising. We're running out of time.
Although I noticed it's 15 hours and 7 minutes till they were too late, right? But at the end, the clock runs out and they go to jump and then somebody else jumps back in. I won't spoil it. And then there's like a happy reunion. I'm like, what about the clock? Damn it.
He's like, his leg is deteriorating and you're all like, yay.
I do love this though, too, when they're looking for the base ship and I think it's here. Mm-hmm. And Starbuck takes the controls of the ship and she sees the glint.
Yeah,
off the, and she's like, it wasn't a comet. The comet is the ship. I love that bit there.
It is this perfect bit of like synchronicity where what you thought was just insanity turns out to have been exactly what they needed all along.
Yep, here it comes. There, look at that.
Look, it's the painting on my wall. Yeah. Katie does Epiphany very well. It's breathless.
Yes.
And I like this bit where it's like the painting and the... Oh, that's very nice.
It morphs into the painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good job, Michael.
Was well that done. In the script or is that something that you just came up with like in your storyboard?
I can't remember. I think it, you know, I think going to the painting, we talked with Gary about, you know, designing it so they could actually go dissolve right into the painting.
Now they get hit with like, is it just stuff that's floating in space? Is that because like when it first happened, I was like, wait, is somebody attacking them? But no, it's just stuff from...
Yeah. Well, there's a line that I want to say, you know, one of the guys in the Raptor says, like, there's ordnance going off all around us, so be careful. Like, you know, missiles that had been on base ships and firepower that is just, you know, floating through space and colliding off of each other and stuff like that. So I think that was kind of what that was supposed to be, is a cluster of missiles that had, you know, ignited.
So if you notice, the dissolve to that broken glass was light shimmering on water. I was trying to... gather together the images from the different stories and blend them together. There's a lot of shiny water imagery in Rosalind's story.
Mm.
Oh.
And I'd never seen, like, there's that beat right before this when the sort of like fleshy goop shield comes down.
Oh, yeah.
To, I guess, seal off the airlock and make the environment legit. Like, that's kind of gross and wonderful. the body horror of the operations of a base ship. Like, it's all alive. It's all organic and giant flesh curtains.
That's all Gary Hudson.
Yeah, we've talked many times about Gary and his brilliance, but also his enthusiasm, and heard from other directors that just said he was so lovely to work with because he just was so excited about it all.
Oh, he was a great filmmaker, and he was, you know, the only visual effects designer on set that I ever worked with who would, you know, break from the plan.
Mm.
And I would come up with an idea on the set and he'd go, oh, if you're going to do that, then I can give you this. And we would just re-storyboard it on the spot.
Wow. Because so much of that stuff is, you know, it's so precise, especially in days before, you know, all of the motion capture tech that you know, we have now. And you look at like behind the scenes of the Marvel stuff and they're just like, yeah, okay, we got a volume. We can figure this out on the fly. But to do this 15 years ago and to make it as seamless and as organic, literally and figuratively, is marvelous.
Now, we made her medicine bloody red.
Very nice.
Another attempt to tie in visuals. There's a whole thing with the hybrid, and her bath turns red from the bloodshed. She gives Kara the information she needs to know. And so we kept trying to find these little visual bits that tie the stories together and make the whole episode feel like one piece.
Tell us a little bit about casting Nana Visitor or Nana Visitor.
Oh, I wish I could take credit for it. It was Ron Moore.
Mm.
He had worked with her, and it was just from the beginning moments of discussing this, it was Nana Visitor.
Yeah. I mean, she was on Deep Space Nine, which is, mm-hmm. you know, one of the places where Ron, not to say cut his teeth, he cut his teeth on Next Generation, but really learned to spread his wings was on DS9. And she was, you know, if not number one on the call sheet, she was like number three. Mm. And yeah, she's an incredibly underrated actress and doesn't work nearly as enough as you would think somebody with that breadth of experience would do. But to see her here and to see her as this kind of, you know, avatar for Rosalind.
She's what a fantastic actor she is, you know, both of those. I mean, Nana Visitor is just brilliant. She's almost a Tricia Helfer.
Almost a Tricia Helfer.
Did I pay you to say that? I don't remember doing that. It's rough in the beginning. It took me a little bit to warm up to her. And then it's just the payoff though, throughout the episode with those two together is stunning.
Did she and Mary have, like, were there acting styles complementary? Like, what was the dynamic working between them? Because it's all a two-hander. Like, pretty much all of Mary's stuff is with her in the episode. And that's a lot of real estate. Like, what was that process?
It was giddy fun. They just clicked, and they're both unbelievably generous actors. So they were there to help each other and to help me, and I was there to help them. And we just thought, how do we make this work without being too sappy and, you know, help the audience along to feel the emotions? And it was all just very lovely. There was no, there were no obstacles in there. Just, you know, how can we be our best was the challenge. And with the two of them, you know, my job was to shut up.
What was the idea of the river? I mean, I guess it was, you know, the writing, but the idea of the river and crossing the river and Baltar, about how that, you know, being one god, and it's the Cylon god, and where did the river come in?
I think it's from Greek mythology, the river Styx. Charon, the boatman who ferries your soul to the other world. You know, because I think the religion in our show is a smorgasbord of so many different religions, but I think there was a lot of that.
And like, rivers do tend to play relatively high in religious sort of iconography. I mean, there's the River Nile that Moses gets found on the banks of, and you know, the Old Testament. It is not an alien thing at all. But, you know, and I suppose Battlestar, you know, somewhat unique among shows, was willing to literalize what is often in other shows just figurative language. Yep. You know, like, when was it always part of the plan to literally shoot on a river, to actually, you know, physicalize that story?
There was a lot of discussion. It's quite expensive to hire a boat and shoot out in the water. I just want to back up a little bit. Just this. Death by door jam is all I've ever done before. And I think this, I love the way this scene turned out. The fact that she's like, doesn't know she's dead, kind of. Yeah. Is that moment with, oh, okay.
Yeah, that delayed reaction. It reminded me of like I don't know why, making me sick to my stomach to think about it, but like an animal, or if a cat gets run over or something, there's that moment of they get up and run. They can sometimes run away, but then they're actually just plop over dead. It was like that. It was like delayed reaction of death.
Yeah. But I think like this scene, like as brutal as it is and as sort of action filled as it is, it's serving to humanize the Cylon in a way that we haven't seen before. Yeah. You know,
right. The Six just can't let it go that Barrel A had treated her like an insect and tortured her on New Caprica when they thought, at least the Sixes thought, they were trying to help.
Yeah, it's the idea that, you know, to a certain degree, it's like genetic memory, right? It's like this thing happened to one of me 3 or 4 generations ago that I haven't been able to shake. And every time I try to go to sleep, I see her face, and I can't live like this, you know?
And now that she's in front of my face, yeah, it's and the door jam, that to me was like just a reaction. Like, if she had thought about it, she wouldn't have done it. Clearly, with what was happening with the, you know, trying to work together with the humans right here. But I remember shooting this and, you know, talking to yourself, right? You're shooting both sides. But I remember that we used as the stand-in Monique Ganderton, was my stunt double for most of the show and all of the show. And I mean, I did most of my own stunts, but she came in when there was something, you know. And she was so lovely because she'd been on the show long enough that she took it so seriously. She didn't just stand there and she learned the lines. She talked opposite me and she gave me, you know, talking about, you talked about Mary and or Rosalind and Emily characters. And you don't often see that, especially if it's, you know, a stand-in that's coming in for day play or whatever. This scene would have been so much harder if I didn't have Monique to really bring it and be there with me and, you know, let me play off of her. And she's just gone on to be like, she's stunt coordinating Marvel movies now. She's an amazing, amazing stunt coordinator. But that was Monique Ganderton opposite me, playing me.
This I think she pulls the trigger. God. The hardest thing I think in this episode was Trisha was you having to play two sixes with different looks and the makeup hair change time.
Yes.
We had to shoot that's half the scene with you as one, and then have a camera lock off, and then you'd go away and we go do some other scene and then come back. And
yeah, to get the wig on, the time to get the wig on, because you'd have to,
yeah,
you know, wig caps or wigs, you have to glue down the hair basically so that the wig doesn't poof up. And it's not a quick changeover, that's for sure.
No, it's a testament to this cast that they could pick it up again, you know, later in the day after having done a scene in between.
Yeah, and back to the energy of it. And what it goes back to, you're saying, of the end of last episode and the beginning of this episode, the benefit of doing the episode, the scene all as one, instead of breaking it up.
Yeah.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I think it's probably unfair that you were the only silent model who has to do a hair change.
Well, I told you why that all came about, right?
Mm-hmm.
It came about from the Pegasus episodes when my hair all fell out from dyeing it blonde. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Ron and everyone at the time about having the six in the cell. I wanted to shave the head, like they had tortured her by shaving her head too, shaving her hair. But that's how it all started, was because my hair fell out.
Yeah, but there's no redheaded eights. There's no like Cavills with long, luxurious hair and a ponytail, like some, you know, hippie god. Nope, just you.
Well, maybe Six was the fashionista of the bunch. Maybe she got bored with one look.
Yeah, God, this is so bleh. Eternity with this hair? No.
The way Mary McDonald listens in the scene is stunning.
Yeah, her eyes are doing so much work.
I mean, you can see the two actors love each other.
Yeah, there's just such a connection. And, you know, obviously with the characters and what they're going through, they're going to have that connection. The way that those two actors portrayed it was heartbreaking.
Yeah. Oh, the hybrid.
I love that Anders doesn't want to go to the hybrid.
No.
He doesn't want to be in front of the hybrid in front of others. He might want to go see it on his own, her on his own, but
yeah,
he doesn't want to get called out.
This is where the Centurions are not, they've been like, they're not unemotional. They're starting to get emotions. Was that mm-hmm. here? Yeah, they're like, they're starting to think.
Yeah, because a couple of episodes ago, the Cavills were dumbing down the Raiders, and so the Sixes and and Leobans and Sharons decided to make the Centurions have the gift of reason.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes back to bite them in the butt here a little bit.
Yeah. And I did like the little tiny story of Anders, just like always kind of wanting to put his fingers in the fire of being a Cylon for real. Like he almost puts his hands in the water to see what would happen if he jacked into the network, and he wants to be with the hybrid, but where nobody else can see him. Like he's just inching closer to who eventually or what eventually he's going to become.
And he's been the one that has been the least of that. We talked about that last episode where if you didn't know, if you had just come onto that episode, you would not have necessarily guessed, aside from the odd side glance he has when Kara said something, you know, about the Cylons. But compared to the other two, compared to Ty and Chief, who are really struggling with it, and Tori, who's fully embraced it, Anders kind of seems like the same guy. But then you just get the odd, like, what if I put my hand in this water? Oh, back with Emily.
Yeah. And I love their differing perspectives on Baltar, you know, in that, you know, Emily's like, no, I voted for you. It's like, and I don't like how it keeps ragging on you, but maybe he stumbled onto something. Like he talks about the river that separates our world from the next, that there's more to this existence that we can see with the naked eye. There's power that we can't begin to understand. And like it's beautiful stuff. And it's, you know, she's crossed a threshold of understanding that Roslyn has yet to get to. You know, like she's the pain is something of a crucible that's burning away her preconceptions of the world around her. And she's seeing with a clarity that Roslyn just isn't there yet.
But I love that she listens. Roslyn is listening. She's not, even with her hate of Baltar, she's not dismissing what Emily is saying.
No. Because I think she recognizes that you know, that is not, this is not easily won information for Emily. Like it's come with a price. And she's familiar with that price. You know, maybe not to that extent, but she's traveled in that currency before. And so she understands that this is not something to be taken lightly.
Yeah.
Oh, hybrid.
Hybrid. I wrote down what she says.
Did you? Because I did too, but I bet you did it better.
Thus will they come to pass. A dying leader will know the truth of the Opera House. The missing three will give you the five who have come from the home of the 13th. You are the harbinger of death, Kara Thrace. You will lead them all to their end. End of line.
Nice. Well done.
My favorite is the missing three will give you the five. I don't know why. I just think that sounds cool. Yeah. But Kara doesn't, she gets hung up on the, as understandable, the harbinger of death part.
Yeah, you'll lead them all to their end. Like, wait,
what?
Me?
Come again?
I'm that girl? I didn't think I was that girl.
And it takes the collective, it takes them all, like Natalie, the six, actually figures out the first part of the clue.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet.
He would have just like swabbed the blood off his leg.
Yeah.
Poor guy. Like I kept feeling for Gata. Like he's feverish and sweaty and just hopped up on drugs and his leg is just rotting as he's watching it. And we're like, let's talk to this lady in the bath for a while. And Gata's like, guys, it's 4 hours left.
It's so like with what happened in after New Caprica. And coming back and you know, the audience knowing that Gata was the spy and giving the clues and that helped the resistance. But what happened to him in collaborators and everything when they get back on the ship and, you know, them almost killing him, the vigilante group of them from New Caprica. It's like that was the start of his just deterioration and hate and not being able to control his hate. And this is just solidifying it. And where we know his character is going in the second half of the season is, you know, from a character that I think everybody loves.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to see his just sort of deterioration.
There's blood in the water. I just wanted to turn the bath red. It's a little bit of a cheat that, you know, your wound would turn the entire bath red, but I wanted the color to italicize this moment.
Yeah. It's stunning to look at. Yeah. But the hybrid.
The hybrid smiles.
Her long scream as she's being disconnected. It was supposed to be a siren, I think, at one point, but the editor cut this, you know, I had her do it on the set, this like moan scream, and he cut it so that it lasted forever.
When I was watching it, I was like, damn, that has to be edited together because that's really long. I mean, I know some singers can just hold a note forever, but there's no way I could have done that. So, but it was probably fairly long anyway.
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, it's inhumanly long.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the hybrid gets unplugged for good. Bye, hybrid. See you later. Thanks for stopping by.
Can she get plugged back in, or she's toast now?
I think we're led to believe she's toast. That like once she's disconnected from the ship, that she and the ship are one, and if she's disconnected from the ship, it's over. But I was also under the impression that this is what, I haven't watched ahead, so I'm not going to spoil anything, but I think this leaves a bit of a vacuum that somebody will have to fill in order for them to jump all the way to Earth, if I remember correctly, which I might not, because I'm old.
I certainly don't remember. Mike, we're purposely not watching ahead to help, like, so we're,
yeah, like
we
I
start
could
bringing
work,
things from but. Future episodes a little bit, aside from, you know, main points that we know, obviously.
Yes, and this ignorance is a bit of a boon. Like, I can't spoil it. I haven't seen it yet. But yeah, this scene again, like it's, ugh. Where Mary's talking about her own mother's experience with breast cancer. And I had forgotten that. I had forgotten that it was a hereditary thing, matrilineally in her family. And God, it's heartbreaking. It's rending to watch her dig this deep.
It's so, so beautiful. Beautifully done.
She kind of looks like a biblical character with that scarf.
Yeah, this is very like fabric. Mother Teresa happening.
Yeah, this was you know, again, a tribute to the cast of this show. There's very little actual movement in this episode. You have 15, 20 minutes of bedside conversation, and you have a bunch of people talking to a chick in a tub. They can't move. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's people are just grounded, just like, you know, there's not a lot of blocking.
But then the movement that you have the mutiny stuff at the beginning, which is all this tense standoff, and then you have the Barrelay and Sixes tense standoff. So you've got the opposite of the rest of the episode that is very quiet and
and then you can just drop anchor for 20 minutes. And have sort of a debate over the value of deities in this world. Like, you know, what good is a god is ultimately what these women are talking about.
The comfort of faith.
Yeah. You know, I want answers to questions I can't get answers to. And that's why we have gods, be they the Lords of Kobol, be they the Cylon god, whatever it is, they're serving a purpose. And that is to know that you're not alone and that there's a reason and then there's a place to go when it's over. And I've always admired, you know, Battlestar's willingness to just do that, to just be like, hey, you know what? You thought this was all about just like toasters and good guys and space battles and all that, but it's actually this very deep meditation on the nature and value of faith and the relative values of different faiths.
And right. This faith to begin with. And it's all just chapters in the book of what it means to be human.
Yeah. God, I hate the show. It makes it so hard for other shows to exist.
That right there. Look at that. Oh, God. Well, I'm watching this again. So this was shot in August of 2007.
August of 2007?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought we finished in 2008.
Are you
How long ago this was?
Wow. And I it pisses me off that Sharon won't comfort her sister, so to speak, and when she knows it's her, you know, there's no resurrection ship. She's dying, as we, you know, in the Barrelay scene, you know, that's the whole reason that six kills the other six is blood for blood. Mm-hmm. She's just as dead as Barrelay. But why won't Sharon comfort her?
Well, because it's, I mean, at least I interpret it as Sharon doesn't want to engage to a certain degree with her own Cylon nature. You know, she's chosen, you know, her opening speech was all about choosing. Like, I've chosen a side and I stick with the side that I chose. And I chose to be with the Colonials and I chose to be, you know, Karl Lagerfeld's wife. And I chose all of these things. And I chose not to be one of you. And Anders, on the other hand, is in the middle of his choice of who he's going to be and who he's going to eventually side with and at least understand his own true nature. And so he's the one. Like, I thought it was really telling that he's the one who comforts her, because he's crossing that threshold a little bit of being able to embrace and find some grace in accepting who he is, even if he won't tell anybody else, even if it's still a secret. But yeah, like, I thought it's one of those scenes that says an awful lot without actually verbalizing very much.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it's beautiful, you know, like he's shaken by it and then chooses to interpret and fuel his own evolution through that uncertainty.
Very well said.
The laying his hands, you know, on her face, closing her eyes. And I'm like, yeah, can't do that anymore. Remember that?
Remember when actors could touch and hold and...
Don't go down that road.
Yes. That red light's madness.
And here's that, you know, there's the sparkling water motif. So this, all the shooting on this boat was one day.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't shoot anything else because we had to go out and load the boat and unload the boat. And our dear line producer, Harvey Frand, who I adored, this day was the only day I ever saw him lose his cool.
Really?
Because we were behind and I had a very ambitious schedule of stuff I wanted to shoot and the boat and the and being on the water. It's all like really ridiculous. I mean, you know, he just lost his cool for a second.
Yeah, he did it very, very rarely. Yeah. But it was one of those when somebody doesn't do that, when they do, oh, you really notice. You're like, yeah. Oh. Yeah. It's beautiful when Rosalind sees her own.
Yeah.
Family. And
I was so hoping that Billy was going to be there.
Oh, Paul Campbell, Billy, yeah. From the first season and a half.
But, you know, schedules being what they were, I'm sure that, like, we got to fly Billy up to Vancouver for this. Like, no, we don't. Actually, it's fine.
When she says, I'm not ready.
Yeah,
it's just.
I remember when we first, when people started looking at the dailies to this, they said, her mother's Barbara Bush?
you know what? I think I did think that as well.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, we don't have to see Emily pass away because we saw her cross the river. Like, we saw her run to her family. And so we know that that was her transitioning to the next phase. And we just see the empty bed and listen to Baltar's voice.
Yeah, the fact that the radio was still on, I mean, obviously why it was, but it was just like, I love that shot. I just love the colors and the empty bed and then coming into the radio, and it's sort of like Mary, Rosalind kind of taking in those words. Yeah. 'Cause she goes to Adama after this and says, maybe I was, you know, I'm starting to change my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, there's a, you know, that green mattress. There was a discussion about that green mattress because there's a, you know, there's a whole story being told by red and green in this episode, where it's red of blood, the red of the bath, the green of the other world, her green mattress. There's hardly any other green in the whole thing.
Mm.
And there's always red when someone dies.
Man. It's like everything that goes into it that I would have never thought about.
Color theory at work.
It's all these little subconscious pings for the audience.
Yeah, and if you, it's not, yeah, exactly. It's subconscious, but it's affecting you, obviously. But this is where I was saying, the clock runs out. Now they're going to be too late.
Yeah.
But, bing, bing.
But then Adama does save it because at the end with Rosalind, he does say that they're overdue. And yeah. He hasn't jumped away yet. So Kara was right in the last episode where she says Adama will wait. Leave. He won't leave us. She was right. He hasn't left, even though they're overdue.
Then they were ready to jump. And then I love this. Just the whang. Giant broken base ship.
Wang?
It's a giant wang, Trisha.
It's a giant
yes,
wang.
It is. It's all broken on the edges. All fucked up from travel. But still, they're so happy to see that giant wang.
I think the wangs look cool.
You know, everybody, Wang Chung. I have lost my mind. Pretty clearly.
I was going to start singing, but then I remembered we had a guest, so.
It's like, I was going to start singing, then I remembered I can't sing, but it's never stopped me before.
And Olmos is in this show.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he had like one scene in 12 weeks because he wasn't at all in last episode.
Yeah, that's, there was quite a few characters that weren't in last episode at all. So,
and then here's another example for, you know, when you have a you know, a couple of cameras and these two actors, my job gets very easy.
How many cameras did you roll on each scene?
We always,
scene like this.
We always rolled two and sometimes three.
Mm.
And, you know, the it's interesting, the approach was, you know, to shoot it as a documentary so that the camera operators never knew what was going to happen next. So that's why the zooms are always a little late and they have to find focus. And we wanted it to look like a news crew was shooting it. And for those cinema nerds out there, we would break the rules of screen direction all the time.
Mm.
So, except in very intimate emotional scenes like this. So screen direction maintains intact. He always looks right to her. She always looks left to him. Mm. But if it wasn't a close, intimate scene, we would break that rule all the time.
Is that, were you talking crossing the line and things like that? After however many years I've been in the business now, I understand the concept, but it doesn't click in my brain. I can't figure it out. It's how they look to each other, right?
It's basically thinking of it as a theater piece. And the line is the proscenium. So
is the what?
It's the proscenium. It's the edge of the stage.
Oh, okay.
The box that they're in, right? So the camera never goes up on the stage. If it's always out in the audience, then all the screen directions works. Once you cross on the stage, then people are looking in the opposite directions.
Okay. That actually helped. Because, I mean, I understood the concept of it,
right,
obviously, but I could never really describe it to someone. So that, thank you.
Yay.
For that visual.
that last scene, you know, where you know, it's Eddie and it's Mary. And you know, he talks about like, yeah, the Earth was always a carrot that I held out for the fleet. And now I think we're actually going to find it. And she's like, well, what made you change your mind? It's like, you made me believe. I'm like, oh, just kiss already.
Oh, and the way he says you is like voice cracks. And
oh, man. It's just
the moment. It's the major moment of the, you know, whole episode. You,
yeah, just, man, just kiss her, dude.
It's actually floating around on YouTube. There's another, you know, 40 seconds of that scene.
Oh, really?
Where the conversation turns back to Baltar. And just YouTube it, and you immediately understand why it was cut.
You know, this is the ending that we need.
Yeah.
This is where that story ends. No, I thought it's such gorgeous. And it's like a lot of it, it's two-hander work. you know, it's that scene, and it's Mary and it's Nana, and it's just great.
Do you have a frack down, Mark?
I do. Michael, in case you're not familiar, the frack down is a notable moment of the episode. It can be good. It's very often good. It can be something that stood out on positive, something stood out on the negative, but just a thing that you took away that stuck with you after watching. Do I have a frack down? Yeah. It's You Made Me Believe.
Really?
Yeah. It's very end. Like, it's just that ongoing story, the very slow romance of those two characters and how they are, you know, they're at the end of the line in a lot of different ways, but it's also the end of that weird courtship that it's pushing forward beyond courtship into actual emotional consummation. And the closer we get there, the more it makes me feel all warm and gooey inside.
Oh, that's a good frack down. Thanks. My frack down, I was between the Gaeta Hilo scene about don't let Doc Cottle take my leg. Mm-hmm. But I think I have to go with Rosalind and Emily and Rosalind talking about her mom. Mm. That scene, she holds the scarf at the end. And I don't know why this is sticking out in my head. I could be completely wrong. But I feel like Mary lost her mom around that time.
Oh, really?
I could be completely wrong, and I don't exactly want to ask Mary.
No, I hadn't thought about it, but I think you're right. I think I remember tiptoeing around that information and then jumping right into it. Mm.
Yeah, so then, I don't know why, but when I was watching it yesterday and now rewatching it and talking about it, just it's in there somewhere. So, yeah, it would be especially.
So I think you're remembering correctly. Yeah.
Wow.
Hmm. Okay. Michael, do you have a frack down that you can think of?
It's I can't remember exactly what scene it is, but it's the moment where Mary's listening to Nana, and you can see that she is starting to crack open to the idea of belief in the gods. And it's just it's a silent reaction shot. And I think I pointed at it, but I can't identify it now exactly, but there's just this, she gets this look of, that she can see into another world. Mm-hmm. And it's very subtle and very clear. Mm.
Yeah, no, that all of that stuff is so beautiful. But yeah, there's moments where you're just on Mary's face and something shifts and it's tiny and it's almost imperceptible, but it's like the lights change, you know, like, oh, she found a thing.
Yeah. So it's not surprising at the end when she talks to Adama about it. You're expecting her to.
Yeah.
To say it. Yeah. Oh, well, wow. This was a beautiful, but kind of more on the heavy side episode.
but
bouts are being heavy.
Yeah, well, we're a lot less chipper right now than we were starting the episode. So.
Oh, but there's laughing. We can laugh.
Yes. And we have next episode. Guess what's coming to dinner?
Guess what's coming to dinner? Very interesting.
Guess what's coming to dinner?
Yes. So what are you up to these days, Michael? You mentioned that you were you were teaching.
Oh, I've been teaching all along, you know, in the cracks between my real jobs. and so this last 2 months, I've been Zoom teaching. Mm. I've been Zoom teaching actors, which I thought was going to be a disaster. But it turned out to be very intimate and effective. And I'm about to start writing a couple of projects. We're still writing. We're not shooting, but we're still writing. So I'm at the very beginning of a couple of writing projects. So that's what I'm doing.
Oh, very cool.
And then reading all the reports of when we're going to get back to the set with an enormous amount of skepticism. But
yeah, I mean, I did see, and I have no idea when people are going to get to listen to this, but the most recent was like, we're trying for July. And I was like, yeah, I don't think so, guys.
Man, I mean, you can try. I'm anxious to shoot again. And I want to be in spite of the danger of infection, I want to be on an early show that gets back to work, just because I want to be part of the discovery process. Because everyone's going to have a plan about how we're going to go back to work. And then when we actually go back to work, the plan's going to disintegrate and we're going to actually have to invent it. And that's going to be exciting.
Right.
You know, finding new ways of doing it. And, you know, I don't know. It's like, I think that, you know, we all our job is always like, okay, it's a disaster. How do we solve it?
It is a lot of problem solving on sets. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it'll just be another version of that with masks on.
With masks on. Yes. Well, I hope for all of our sakes, you get to do so.
Yeah.
And you get to do the work that you love doing and are so very good at doing.
Thank you.
And getting to help problem solve this. Because you're right. No plan survives contact with the enemy. So.
Or what's the other version? Is everyone has a plan until they get hit.
Too true. But thank you so much, Michael, for taking time out of your morning.
Pleasure.
Yes. And we will.
You guys are great.
Oh, well, it's all her fault. She brings all the great.
It's all my fault?
Yes.
What? Oh. I don't believe like, you guys. Was...
like, did you slide a compliment in there, you son of a bitch? wow. But yes, thank you to Michael Nankin. Can the people find you on the internet anywhere? You on the Twitters or the Instagrams or the whatevers that you want to send them to?
I'm on Facebook.
Okay. Do you want people going there? We don't have to send them anywhere.
I also have I started a page called, I live in a place called Bowen Island, and I started a Facebook page called Bowen Island Co-Video Page. Nah. It's a daily short movie clip or dance number or animation that's like an amuse-bouche for your day, like a little happy cinematic treat.
Oh, nice.
So I've been doing it for 2 months now. There's like 100 of them.
Wow.
Bowen, right?
Yeah, Bowen Island Co-Video Page.
Awesome. I will check it out.
All right. But yes, thank you, Michael, for coming on this morning. Thank you to Bear McCreary, as always, for his fantastic theme song. Thank you to Sci-Fi and Sci-Fi Wire for continuing to fund our weird foray into the insane. And thank you to Brett Boehm and the gang at Forever Dog for making us sound good. And thank you, as always, to Fiona's butt.
Woo, woo. For yeah. Fiona's my cat that you saw constantly moving back and forth.
Yes, around. Who just waves that cat butt in front of Trisha like constantly. She's shameless. Shameless.
Now we don't have smell-o-vision.
Yes. Paint me like one of your French cats.
Exactly.
Yeah. But thank you to Trisha.
And thank you, Mark.
Yay. And so we will see you all next week for Guess What's Coming to Dinner. Until then, be safe.
Always.
So say we all.